I noticed them, because people changed after spending time with them. Not loudly, not all at once, just a slight tilt in posture, a new eagerness, a hunger to please that hadn't been there before. They came back from lunches brighter, more invested, more willing to bend. They spoke the couple's names with an odd reverence, like they'd been granted access to something exclusive. I watched calendars rearrange themselves around dinner invitations. I watched favors get framed as opportunities. I watched boundaries soften, without anyone acknowledging they had ever existed. They didn't shout, or threaten, or demand. They smiled. They remembered details. They told you how special you were, how rare your skill set was, how lucky the organization was to have you. And then, when you'd given enough, when your usefulness peaked, they withdrew. Calls slowed. Messages went unanswered. The warmth cooled into distance that made you question whether you'd imagined the closeness at all. I didn't fall for them the way others did, but I was close enough to feel the drag, close enough to see the pattern, close enough to understand that what looked like charm was a system, and what felt like intimacy was just technique. I was a mid-level manager at a consultancy that liked to call itself People First and operated like every other place that said that out loud. We sold insight, efficiency, trust. Our clients were corporate, our culture was polished, and our internal politics were as sharp as anywhere I'd worked before. That was where I met them. They arrived together, not officially as a package deal, but close enough that it was obvious. He was brought in as a senior strategist with an impressive resume and a way of speaking that made you lean forward. She followed a few months later as a client relations lead, introduced to someone who would strengthen our external partnerships. They were married. They didn't hide it. They didn't weaponize it openly either. It just hovered around them, a soft authority, a sense that they were already aligned in ways the rest of us could never be. At first, they seemed generous. They hosted informal gatherings, small dinners that felt intimate without being exclusive. They framed it as community building. They praised people publicly and privately. They asked questions that made you feel seen, remembered details that suggested care. When I watched them in meetings, I noticed how they split the room. He would draw out ideas, nodding, validating, letting others think they were leading the conversation. She would follow up later, refining, redirecting, suggesting next steps that quietly aligned those ideas with their own priorities. It was subtle enough that no one objected. It was smooth enough that people thanked them for it. I've been around long enough to know that power rarely announces itself. It flatters. It reassures. It tells you you're safe. The warning signs were there if you knew how to look. The way they mirrored language back to people, just slightly adjusted. The way they never quite committed to anything concrete unless it benefited them twice. The way they gathered information in casual conversation and then used it later, framed as insight. They were never overtly cruel. They didn't need to be. Their leverage came from access and approval. I saw the first real shift in a junior consultant named Emma. She was smart, capable, hungry in the way people are when they want to be recognized but don't yet know how to protect themselves. After a few dinners and a handful of late-night work sessions framed as mentorship, she became fiercely loyal to them. She volunteered for extra projects tied to their initiatives. She defended them in meetings before anyone had criticized them. Her workload doubled. Her confidence seemed to spike and then thin out, stretch too far. When she finally burned out, when she asked for a pause, they expressed concern in the abstract and then quietly replaced her with someone else. Emma left the firm within 6 months, convinced she'd failed them, not the other way around. That was when I started paying closer attention. I watched who got invited and who didn't. I watched how favors were requested, always framed as chances to grow. I watched how gratitude was expressed, just enough to keep people engaged, but never enough to feel settled. They hunted as a pair. He softened the ground. She closed the loop. They made people feel chosen, then made them chase that feeling. I wasn't immune to their charm. They tried it on me too. Invitations, compliments, subtle acknowledgments of my experience. I accepted lunches. I listened. I smiled. But I didn't overextend. I didn't rearrange my calendar. I didn't give them anything they couldn't get elsewhere. That restraint marked me, not negatively at first, but noticeably. I wasn't as useful. I wasn't as pliable. I became an observer by default. The firm rewarded collaboration on paper and competition in practice. That tension created space for people like them to thrive. They never broke rules. They just interpreted them creatively. They understood that systems protect those who appear to add value, especially when that value is hard to quantify. Influence, morale, client goodwill, these were their currencies, and they spent other people freely to acquire them. The real damage didn't happen all at once. It happened through accumulation, small asks layered on top of each other until people were buried under obligations they hadn't agreed to consciously. The couple positioned themselves as connectors, the bridge between opportunity and execution. If you wanted access to certain clients, certain projects, certain rooms, you went through them, not officially, just practically. They became gatekeepers without being named as such. I watched as a senior analyst named Mark got pulled into their orbit. He was experienced, cautious, not easily impressed. They appealed to his sense of legacy, his desire to mentor, his frust with great age and speech and death, the center of details. They leaned on his expertise in ways that flattered him. Slowly, his independent projects got deprioritized in favor of theirs. His calendar filled with meetings that produced little beyond momentum for the couple's initiatives. When he raised concerns about scope creep, they reframed it as leadership responsibility. When he pushed back harder, they expressed disappointment, not anger. That was their preferred tool. Disappointment made people scramble. Mark stayed. He compromised. He told himself it was temporary. He told himself it was strategic. When the firm restructured, his role was eliminated. The couple expressed shock. They sent thoughtful messages. They moved on. By then, the pattern was impossible to ignore, but still difficult to name. There was no single incident to report, no policy violation to cite, just a trail of depleted people and enhanced reputations. The couple advanced. They were praised for building culture, for fostering engagement, for driving results. Leadership saw what it wanted to see. Metrics looked good. Complaints were scattered and vague. No one wanted to sound bitter or incompetent. No one wanted to admit they'd been used. I felt complicit by proximity. I didn't stop them. I didn't warn everyone. I chose my battles, told myself I couldn't save people who didn't ask. That rationalization sits heavy in hindsight. There were moments I could have spoken up more clearly, named what I was seeing. I didn't, partly because I understood how systems respond to discomfort. They isolate the messenger. They protect the narrative. The couple eventually turned their attention toward me more directly. Not with warmth, but with curiosity. They tested boundaries. They asked for endorsements, for public alignment, for subtle support in meetings. I offered neutrality. I praised good ideas without attaching myself to them. I refused to become a shield. That resistance shifted their approach. Invitation stopped. Information flow narrowed. I was no longer inside their circle. I became, quietly, an obstacle. The tension surfaced during a major client pitch. Their strategy leaned heavily on work produced by a team they'd hollowed out. I raised questions about sustainability, about credit, about risk. I didn't accuse. I didn't dramatize. I asked reasonable questions in a room that preferred enthusiasm. The silence that followed was thick. The couple smiled. They answered smoothly. Leadership nodded. The pitch moved forward. After the meeting, I received a message from her. polite, measured, disappointed. She suggested I might be misaligned with the firm's direction. She framed it as concern for my growth. I recognized the move, isolation disguised as mentorship. I didn't respond immediately. I let the moment breathe. When I did reply, I kept it factual, calm, unyielding. I didn't apologize for asking questions. I didn't seek reassurance. That was the moment they stopped trying to recruit me and started trying to contain me. My projects were scrutinized more closely. My access narrowed. It wasn't retaliation in any official sense. It was pressure. Quiet, persistent, plausible. I stayed because I could, because I had leverage of my own. Others weren't as lucky. The couple's downfall, if it can be called that, didn't come from exposure. It came from saturation. They overextended. They used too many people too visibly. The trail became harder to ignore. Clients noticed inconsistency. Turnover increased. Leadership commissioned a review framed as optimization. The findings were sanitized, but the impact was real. The couple were reassigned. Their influence diluted. They left within a year, not disgraced, just displaced. They landed elsewhere, I'm sure. People like them always do. After they left, the office didn't heal immediately. There was a lag, a period where people recalibrated, unsure which norms still applied. Some felt relief. Others felt abandoned, confused by the sudden absence of the attention they'd come to rely on. A few reached out to me quietly, asking if I'd seen it too, if they were imagining things. I listened. I didn't validate everything. I didn't invalidate it either. I let people tell their stories in their own words. Emma resurfaced in my thoughts often. Mark II. The couple hadn't ruined lives outright. They just redirected them. Drained them. Reshaped them in ways that took time to undo. That kind of harm is hard to measure and easy to dismiss. It doesn't leave marks that HR recognizes. It leaves hesitation, mistrust, fatigue. I stayed at the firm another year, long enough to see new dynamics form, new power centers emerge. Different faces, similar patterns. I learned again what I already knew. Workplaces don't create predators. They reward them. They create conditions where charm outperforms integrity, where results eclipse methods, where people are resources first and humans second. When I left, it wasn't dramatic. No exit speech, no exo pay, just a quiet departure. I carried the lessons with me. I became more direct in naming patterns, at least to myself. I trusted my discomfort sooner. I watched how people treated those with less power, how they handled no, how they responded when they couldn't extract value. Those details matter. I still think about the couple sometimes, not with anger, but with a kind of cold clarity. They weren't monsters. They were efficient. They understood something uncomfortable about human nature and exploited it without apology. They believed the ends justified the means, and the system agreed often enough to make it worth their while. Watching them taught me that harm doesn't always announce itself as harm. Sometimes it arrives as opportunity, dressed in warmth, asking only that you give a little more. Sometimes the most dangerous people are the ones who make you feel chosen. And sometimes the hardest thing isn't surviving them, but admitting you almost wanted to belong.